Hello and welcome to episode 33 of the Oxfordshire Teacher Training Podcast. I'm Matthew Coatsworth and I'm sitting down this afternoon with Mike Goves. Mike is the CPLD lead for the River Learning Trust, which is the trust that Oxfordshire Teacher Training belongs to. This afternoon we're going to be thinking about metacognition. So Mike, welcome.
Well, thank you very much.
Let's think about what metacognition is and also perhaps why an early career teacher or a trainee teacher would need to know about metacognition.
Sure. So I suppose straight off the bat it's worth just preempting. It's a huge, complex area. And so what we'll do is try and unpick it a little bit. First of all, and the most obvious, it's now explicitly on the ECF, which in terms of previous incarnations of teacher training, and various different PGCEs and the like in the last sort of 20, 30 years, it certainly wouldn't have been and wouldn't have had the prominence that it has now. So from the ECF, it actually states now, explicitly teaching pupils metacognitive strategies linked to subject knowledge, including how to plan, monitor and evaluate, supports independence and academic success, which is great to see that on the ECF because that is essentially all true in the sense of corroborated by some prior robust evidence. What is it? It, first of all, is a set of behaviours, plural. And what those behaviours do, and this is true for anyone or all people, they allow us to monitor and control our thinking and our motivation in order to complete a particular objective, task or goal. So therefore, we have to have a lot of cognition to go into that metacognition. We have to have a task or a problem that we're aiming to solve. We need to be aware of ourselves, our motivation levels, what we know about the task, what we know about how we might solve it, and we need to know about what we're doing actively in that, all sort of at the same time, they all interrelate. So that's what metacognition, I suppose, is. So I kind of wish when I trained in 2005, I wish there was more emphasis on this because it can provide such substantial gains in student learning. And if you look at some literature on supporting this, it's second only to feedback when it comes to student progress, and that those gains are equally, if not more, shown with disadvantaged students. It's the area of teaching practice that is directly aimed at building confident, independent learners who can self-regulate. Well, who wouldn't want that? Now, I totally understand and appreciate that it's not new. This is not a new thing. It's not even a new word. The word was coined by John Flavel in 1976. At the time, I think it's true to say that his interpretation or the definition of the term was active monitoring and consequent regulation of thought processes, usually in the service of some goal or objective, I think is what he said. So it's already a bit unwieldy. And then that got broken down into metacognitive knowledge. Somewhere along the line, there was a word meta-memory as well. And that metacognitive knowledge was of self, others, tasks, and strategies. And then you grow that knowledge through experience, goal setting, and then identifying effective and ineffective strategies. He would have had a very clear mental model for this, but then trying to reinterpret that evidence in now is if you're a mentor or an AT or an ECT, you could easily just be thinking, well, this is a fantastic word salad. But it's not a thing. You don't do metacognition. You behave metacognitively. And so that's how I think in terms of phrasing it for mentoring purposes and for how to go about understanding it from the word go from an ECT. It's really fundamental to recognize this is a long-term endeavor to build a set of behaviors that ultimately become so ingrained and automatic that a learner kind of doesn't need you anymore by the time they've left, you know, school. And appreciate that's probably likely to be by the time they're in year 13. And so I break it down into the following. So the first one being motivation. And when I'm thinking about how to build metacognitive behaviours, I'm thinking about the motivation of the students to even bother. Why is this important? Who cares? How hard is this? Am I likely to try? And sort of what are the things that might be holding me back in trying? So I've got a category of M. So I write this out as a scaffold or M at the start, motivation. And then we need to build some knowledge in terms of our behaviours. I have to have some substance behind them. So I have a K now, capital K. I have a K me. So I have knowledge of me. So as a learner, what do I know about me? But let's say we're talking about something sciencey, because that's my field and I love it. What do I know about this area of science? And I need to understand that first before I actually go any further. Then I have another K, knowledge of the task. So do I understand what the task is asking of me? Does it make sense? Do I know even what all the words mean? And then my final K is S, and this is the big one, really, from a teacher's point of view, knowledge of strategies. So do I have any strategies that will help me answer or tackle this task or this problem? But this is where it's actually really important to teach this, because we're quite flawed in terms of, I mean, humans are amazing in so many ways, and as is our brain, but it is relatively flawed in the sense of independently, spontaneously coming up with strategies to solve a variety of tasks and problems efficiently and effectively. So, you know, we're great at trial and error, for example, but that's not a very efficient way of solving a problem. So the strategies are likely going to come from the teaching, and it could be really subject specific. You know, so if you're thinking about how to teach gravity or how to teach ionic bonding, there will be ways and means by which that is more relatable and understandable, and there's strategies, whether it's a mnemonic, a diagram, an example, a model that you could physically see, something concrete that will help become part of the student's strategies for how they go about solving a particular problem related to that. So just to quickly recap, so I've got my capital M, motivation, which kind of speaks for itself, but I'll probably emphasize later on, is highly related to emotions. Knowledge, and there are three Ks: knowledge of me, my understanding and who and what I know, knowledge of the task, so what is it asking me to do, and am I clear about this, and knowledge of strategies with which I might have to be able to solve said task. And then, so the final aspect is R, capital R for regulation. And this, I think, this R is what a lot of people understand by metacognition, because this part involves planning, monitoring, and evaluation. So before I start this task, am I thinking about how I'm going to tackle it? What am I likely to do? Am I planning it out in my head? Am I talk to someone about what I think the answer might be? Do I know where I might start? Have I got somewhere where I can go to refer to later on ready? Then as I'm answering this task or this problem challenge, how's it going? Is it going well? Am I finding it tricky? And then the final R is for evaluation. So my RE, can I check my answer now? Check it for quality, check it for perhaps quantity, check it for accuracy in terms of language. Also be checking about the effort I've put in, you know, and if I have got obviously models and worked examples and or sorry, probably model answers is the better one to go to, does it look anything like that? And so that's how I make sense of it. So I've got my M, my motivation, my knowledge section, so of me, the task and strategies, and my regulation section, my R's, my RP for planning, my RM for monitoring, my RE for evaluation.
Let's think about what metacognition isn't rather than what it is, and the kind of myths and misconceptions that we need to be careful of.
I think there's a misconception that metacognition is only for older students. I mean, that is certainly not the case. A fair bit of research bears out, a bit like theory of mind, really, metacognitive behaviours develop from around the age of 3. Even the EEF actually has a nice little independent behaviours audit checklist, breaking down behaviors into four categories, I think it is. So emotional, things like, you know, can the pupil resist distraction and to what extent? Pro-social behaviors, so can they resolve problems with peers? Cognitive ones, so can they speak about how they have done something, particular activity? And motivational behaviors, so, you know, do they initiate activities, for example? So certainly not just for older students. I have two young children myself. So, you know, one's 3.5 and one's nearly 5. And I can relate all of that previous scaffold actually to morning routines. You know, are you ready for school? No, not yet. Okay. What do we need to do first? Get dressed. Sure. Where do you need to go to get those things? My cupboard. What do you need to get? My clothes. In which order should you get dressed in? And you're basically going through the list of motivation, the knowledge of the task, even however straightforward that is in terms of getting themselves ready and dressed. But that's where it starts. I'm asking the questions deliberately so that they're starting to build an automatic understanding of how to do what they're doing, but also why they're doing what they're doing, and that they can then ask themselves those questions, so they don't need me to keep asking the same things every single day.
I'm really pleased that you've said metacognition is not something that we think of as, oh, that's what you do in secondary schools. Absolutely not at all. But that whole sense of thinking about that morning routine, the one that, you know, one that we can really think about very clearly ourselves, getting from that stage of someone, so in this case it was you as a parent, asking the questions to then enable, to actually turn that then into a series of routines and habits that mean that the young child is then able to start to self-regulate themselves and start to think, okay, so I know that, I need to do that.
And I'm sure there's a lot of intuitive questioning that happens, that people can now kind of go, oh, so that was me building metacognitive behaviours, I just didn't know to call it that. And that's obviously great. The one I think is probably, this is a can of worms. So metacognition is best taught generically in standalone, let's call them thinking skills, critical skills, learning to learn lessons. I don't think that's true. However, it could emerge, it could not be effective. If you did, it's all about implementation. So put simply, you can't have any metacognition if you've got no cognition. So you can't apply what you don't know. And so therefore, you know, there has been a bit of a trend in the last decade or so to really focus on a knowledge-rich curriculum, knowledge foundational, and it actually does refer in the ECF to knowledge being foundational, and thinking skills come after that. Now, that is contentious in itself. There's debate around that even now. Dan Willingham would kind of subscribe to that, and why students don't like school sort of supports that. But actually, if you look in that book as well, he does then say, that's not always the case. You have to have them in parallel. And I think the parallel nature is really important, because I wouldn't want for metacognition, as the way I understand it, to be somehow conflated in a debate around traditional progressive knowledge skills, because learning just doesn't operate like that. There has to be a continuum, and they are mutually compatible. So, you know, whilst I would obviously say you can't apply a learning strategy to a task when you don't have any knowledge of in the first place, of course you can't. That doesn't actually play out most of the time in schools. Most of the time, a school environment, though, tasks are subject specific, requiring subject specific strategies. So that is probably fair why the knowledge element seems to sort of carry more weight. But as I've kind of just tried to exemplify, you can ask questions which build metacognitive behaviours, which have got nothing to do with, you know, my understanding of the mole or atomic structure. You know, so things like, where do I start? What do I already know? What is this task asking me? How confident am I? How good is this answer? How does my answer compare to model? So if you have a standalone curriculum that can build behaviours, but it would be really actually effective if that is then embedded within subject-specific content in the classrooms, and the two are utterly compatible in that regard. Neither one nor the other. Why do we need to keep searching for dichotomies? We don't. We can have both, and over time we're just building a set of behaviours. And I suppose the final point, because it's just triggered in my mind, is that, you know, there might be an assumption that people accurately assess their own abilities, know, quite well. So if you ask somebody, you know, is this task difficult, or what do you know about this, they'll just say, oh yeah, it's quite easy, yeah, I know quite a lot actually. From our understanding of brain development, at least up to the age of 8, we're quite inaccurate with that, and overestimate, typically far more than underestimate. And actually, you know, related to the Dunning-Kruger effect, so those who perform in the bottom quartile of particular tasks and assessments, this is obviously from research pieces, are the people who overestimate their abilities as well. So it's like a double whammy of inaccuracies. And so, you know, we can't really rely on our own intuitions necessarily to just think about, without actually challenging, how much do we really know. So we do need to build a set of behaviours that help make us better learners over time, I think. So
the question that you've just kind of almost posed in my own mind now is that very one about how we've got to be able to support, as teachers, we've got to be able to support children to really properly understand how well they're doing with something and how they can get better at something. Because, as you say, there's enough evidence to suggest that particularly certain groups and certain ages of children will overestimate their ability to be able to do something, And obviously, conversely, we've also got some people who are very, very most able people that we're working with sometimes will then underestimate just how well they're doing because they're just looking for that little bit to try and improve and improve and improve. And if they haven't quite got there. Mike, what would be really useful for us to think about now is let's imagine now we're thinking very much about our trainees and so our associate teachers, as we call them. What kind of things might they want to kind of incorporate into their own practice some kind of practical tips of things that you might suggest?
First and foremost, you know, the ECF does give some guidance on this. Yeah. So, you know, narrating thought processes when you're modelling to make explicit how experts think. Now, challenge is they are not necessarily experts in all aspects of pedagogical content knowledge. So that in itself is a challenge. But it gives an example. So asking questions aloud that people should consider when working independently, making the steps in a process memorable and ensuring people can recall them. And that's where you're building the sort of the KS, the strategy knowledge. So, you know, mnemonics, for example, or linking some content to a memorable story. I think more on a more sort of practical approach, if I was in the classroom, I would have, let's say I was giving a worked example. Instead, in the past, maybe of just kind of going through the worked example and perhaps occasionally asking a question, so what should I do now, etc., I would actually, in another colour on the board, be also writing every thought I had at the same time as going through and solving the problem itself and making it utterly explicit that my role here is completely twofold now. It's to help you understand how to answer this problem, but of equal value, it's how did I go about thinking about solving that problem and writing all of that down too? Because, and it will take longer, actually, because you're capturing some of the comments that you might have said verbally, but you are actually explicitly putting them onto the board now for people to reflect on and digest and wrestle with themselves and then ask of themselves, well, did I think that or did I not? Why didn't I think that? Oh, I could think like that in the future. So I do think to start with, it would be really wise to have a separate section almost or around your worked example on a board or visualizer or wherever you're doing it to write down what you're thinking and what you're doing. I say two different colours just to give a sort of visual distinction between the two. Dr. James Mannion and his work with Kate McAllister, so they did his PhD was an 8-year study actually to look at a learning skills curriculum. And within that, there's metacognition, there's self-regulation, but they really emphasise the importance of oracy in all of this. So the internal self-talk and then the outward verbal talk of the thought process behind something. And they made that part of their curriculum. So they would have pupils to explicitly ask them to self-narrate in their mind from a series of prompts, similar to what I was mentioning earlier. What do I understand by this topic? What do I know? How do I think about this? Where should I start? Then turn and talk to their partner about exactly that. Where are you going to start? How much do you know about this? What can we do to improve our answer now? And then deliberately later on include another third person into that. So the first step was actually kind of crucial in terms of the motivation. The pupils were not put together. It was completely voluntary who they worked with, because I think sometimes within the notion of control and perhaps efficiency, we have seating plans and we do it our way. We've got to be careful with that, because our goal is not to really, I hope, just get people to do what we want. It's to help them learn and understand. And a big part of that is social and emotional. And therefore, they're not going to want necessarily to turn and talk to someone who they don't know very well, or there's not a great relationship with, or, you know, they might like, you know, so we've got to be attuned to that. So, you know, this might be quite high risk, but one potential strategy is your seating plan, your rule is you sit where you think you're going to learn best. And that means I would like you to talk to someone who's next to you about the learning. And ultimately you kind of got to let them get that wrong a bit, perhaps. But in the process, what you're doing is building their capacity to develop their oracy skills. And then what that's doing is building their capacity to self-explain, internalize the narration of thought. And then that is a really key step. So their research bears out of actually building really, really powerful metacognitive behaviors. Slightly flies in the face of some behavioral routines, I appreciate. But I think there's an undercurrent of high trust, low stakes, and any opportunities to allow or not to expose failure as a problem is a really key component in building metacognitive behaviors. Because if you're worried about saying the wrong thing, getting the wrong answer, focusing on the outcome rather than the process, it's a huge roadblock into anything in terms of metacognitive behaviours.
So at the time of recording this, it's the middle of May. So we're very much in public exam season for secondaries and primaries. I've just had Key Stage 2 SATs a few days ago as well. You can hopefully pick up already that you know, if you're building this in right from the very beginning, you're actually helping the pupils, the students, in developing some approaches to their own revision and making them help to be able to think about, okay, what do I need to do in order to be able to do fantastically well when I do get to these milestone points as we go through. Because I think one of the key things to bear in mind with anything around the whole topic that we've been thinking about today is that actually this isn't all really about going towards exams. It's much bigger than that.
So I think you hit upon the biggest challenge in terms of the teachers thinking about this and perhaps the constraints of the system. So what we are trained typically to do, especially currently, I would say that's fair, is all about efficiency. So we teach in a very efficient model. We treat students as novices because, well, fundamentally they are, and they're certainly more likely to be. And therefore they need direct instruction, typically, as a strategy that's likely to bring about effective outcomes. If it is indeed the outcome of getting the most number of students as quickly as possible, the highest grades. The problem is they are also novices in self-regulation. And so how can an individual become independent or more independent if they are so tightly controlled? It's not likely to happen just by itself. And this is why self-regulated learning and metacognition being a part of that is so key. And it's the kind of process and approach, albeit with a lot of patience involved, that should avoid the questions like, I'm at the bottom of the page, what do I do now? Or I finished, now what? Or where's the chair gone? Or what do I do after the title? We know we've got it wrong when we hear these kinds of things. And I totally understand and accept the point about, you know what, exams do happen. And that is the only real benchmark we have, potentially, in measuring success of learning. But I am certainly in the camp that says that is not necessarily the most important measure. And even if it was, there is a process to get that can also be, you know, managed slightly differently. So let's say about the point about revision. First of all, it's really important that this entire endeavor of building metacognitive behaviors starts from three, primary school, certainly, and because we're building habits and behaviors. The second thing I'd say is, we're talking about revision, we need to be clear about a couple of assumptions at this point that I think is worth raising. So revision, actually, the assumption therefore is that learning has already happened. So this is revising, this is revisiting. And, you know, if the learning hasn't actually been secure, then students aren't revising, they're still learning. And so really, we there shouldn't be any surprises about this. And I think sometimes, going back to the point about misunderstanding your own knowledge and abilities, I think some pupils do falsely think, well, they've finished, they know it all. And actually, they believe that. And I believe them that they believe that. But actually, without enough proof, it's more of a fleeting recall scenario. And when it actually comes down to it, it's not in their long-term memory and they struggle. And that then might be misappropriated as it's an exam technique problem. And you know what? Probably isn't. It's you don't know it yet. So, you know, just to be clear, I'll get that out of the way. Let's assume they're revising. So first of all, in terms of how do you get to this point? the tasks, activities, challenges, etc., that you want to be applying these any strategy to need to be challenging. And that's really important. So, you know, we might talk about it in terms of zone of proximal development. You know, children won't care about that language. They just say, look, is this hard? And they, we need to be providing hard work, which requires hard thinking, because otherwise you don't really need to activate many metacognitive behaviors. So making sure there's some sort of way of checking in on that pupils find things difficult, but just about achievable, that's where you're going to most productively build metacognitive behaviors. But maybe if I go with it from a student perspective, so if students are behaving metacognitively and that's applying to their revision as well, the kinds of things they would be doing then and thinking would be identifying, rating and choosing strategies to revise based on how effective they think that's going to be. So let's say, for example, I'll just say this all in the first person. I'm going to make a series of flashcards and I'm going to use the Leitner method. Because, and this word's going to have to come up with all everything, because I don't have these facts in my long-term memory yet. I know this because when I was quizzed, I couldn't get the answer right without looking up in my notes or asking my buddy over there. So that would be something that is a choice. They're aware of their self, their own knowledge. They need to be motivated enough to do that. They need to have strategies like how to design a flashcard rather than write 1500 words in size 3 font on a card and think it's really a flashcard. They need to have a strategy of the Leitner method, which would need to have been taught. And then they would need to know to use that because of a knowledge deficiency. So I'm going to complete this essay in time conditions because I haven't actually practiced my knowledge under that pressure yet. And that's what will happen in the real thing. And so if I can't complete this activity in the time I'm allowed when it comes down to it, then obviously, I might not get the grades I want. So that's something that could be done, known for a reason. Another example could be, I'm stuck. So I need to ask myself some questions like, have I seen a question like this before? What did I do? Do I have a worked example in my book, in my notes? Do I understand it? Can I explain it for myself or out loud? And then, you know, what I try and work students towards is recognizing whether they need more, whether they need to know more, or whether they need help with applying that. Because if they're able to make that distinction, revision becomes way more effective. Because a lot of the time, as I think I've probably mentioned, you know, it's a knowledge issue that they can resolve. An understanding and application issue, I can massively help with there. Perhaps another one might be, I'm going to try the hardest question I can. And I'm going to answer that in a blue pen. And then when I can't answer it anymore, I'm going to go back to my textbook or my notes or both, and I'm going to carry on answering in another colored pen. And then I'm going to check my answer with the mark scheme or my teacher. And I need, what I'm doing there is I'm marking both. How much did I know from my own memory? How many marks did I get for that? How many marks did I get when I used some other support mechanism? And then I know, I'm telling myself what's in my long-term memories and what isn't yet. And then in the round, I'm going to see what mark I would get if I had all of those together. And then I could perhaps go to my teacher with that and say, right, this is the work I've done in my revision. What can I do now to improve? Because there's nothing worse than going, right, we're going to do some revision clinics. And they'll turn up, go, and literally sit there and they just look at you. And then like, what are we doing today, sir? Well, you're revising, aren't you? Yeah, but what do I do? How do I know? Where do you want to start? So, you know, the whole point, by the time we get to that stage, I mean, you got to rewind about 3 terms and start again. Yeah. But basically, we're working towards, you know, everything that's internalized in our minds about how we would have not got to that point. We need to make explicit and drip fed along the way so that doesn't happen. And maybe that, you know, one final perhaps concrete example could be, and people talk about things like exam wrappers and stuff like that. I'll mention an example a bit like this, but I'll also couple it with failure. I think Guy Claxton called it floundering intelligently. So you complete a set of exam questions or just an assessment, for example. And as a teacher, you are potentially aware that their approach was relatively poor, but you didn't do anything about it. Deliberately, as part of your thinking, and so you give them a reflection activity afterwards. You don't even necessarily say that's going to happen. And in that, the the tasks are asking them, you know, what knowledge did you not know when you see the answers now? And just to make that known to them. Were there any sort of questions that you didn't understand? And what were they? But then also, you know, and I've done this before, is asking, what did you do to prepare for this as an assessment or task? And it's kind of a grid with checkboxes. And I'll just read a few because there are 20 different options to choose from in my latest version. So highlighted notes, wrote and or summarized my notes, taught or explained the concepts to others, used model answers to check and improve my own, looked up answers on the internet or Reddit or student room, practice questions I previously got wrong before completing this, turned my notes into diagrams or visuals or mnemonics. And what I'm doing there is I'm deliberately including low value strategies in that, because what might well happen is that, and it would be far more powerful if it was to happen this way, the students then draw a correlation between, oh, you know what? I didn't do very well. What did I do to prepare? Well, in the worst case scenario, nothing. But also, oh, no, actually, I worked really hard. Okay, what did you do? Well, I highlighted and reread my notes and I wrote them out 5 times. Sure. And then how did that relate to the improvements that you made? Not very well. So what does that tell you about a strategy, how effective that was for this? It wasn't very. Ah, fantastic. So let's make that now an action to commit to. And there's just a final point there at the bottom, which says actions I will now take to improve my understanding. And then that you only have to commit to one, but ideally three. And, you know, you have to let the controlled failure happen in order for the deep learning and understanding of what it is to build metacognitive behaviors to really take hold. So otherwise it will come across as a, no, I'm telling you to do this. And all I'm doing is going back to the thing I dislike about controlling their everything they do and say. And I don't want to control them. I want to let them understand and learn for themselves how they can improve their own learning and how they go about preparation and what is and isn't effective.
Fantastic. And in fact, if we then bring that round and think about the role of the mentor working with the associate teacher or early career teacher, that maybe at the beginning there's going to be more direct instruction of, you know, this is what you need to do. But that whole model, we talk about the kind of direct mentoring into coaching model, and that sense of actually this latter part is in effect very similar to what you've just been describing there, of actually it's the final actions need to be made by the individual, by the trainee teacher, by the early career teacher, by the pupil, not by the person who's telling them what to do at that last stage. You've talked a little bit about the EEF, the Education Endowment Foundation. You talked about the impact that we can see for things like metacognition and feedback as being the two kind of things that they've proven have got the biggest impact at the moment. But they've also produced a really useful guidance report, which the most recent version of which came out in October 2021, so less than a year ago now. Are there any other things that you would recommend that listeners look into if they want to find out a bit more about what they can do and get an even deeper understanding about self-regulated learning and metacognition?
I'm aware of one of the criticisms of the EEF's research is that it overemphasises the role of cognition of metacognitive behaviours. Research I've been delving into more recently is from, and I think mentioned earlier, James Mannion and Kate McAllister, and it's just highlighting the role of emotion and self-efficacy and problem solving as well. And so their model looks at self-regulated learning being broken down into self-regulation, when that is monitoring and controlling those feelings, emotions, you know, in particular, and behaviors as well. And metacognition being controlling and monitoring your thought processes. And then oracy, which is about speaking and listening across a range of subjects. So I would say, you know, that would be good. There's a really good, quite long, because it's a big area, podcast with Ollie Lovell about that. You know, perhaps even if you wanted a slightly different take on metacognition and how to apply it, the Metacognition Handbook by Jennifer Webb is really good. And it cites, or she cites rather, Tova Mikalski's work in this area. It's really interesting, actually. And it doesn't use the sort of plan, monitor, evaluate language quite the same way. So Mikalski's approach is just a four-step one, which is comprehend, connect, strategy, evaluate. So, and that's actually really in line with cognitive science about how we actually learn.
So, Mike, it's been absolutely brilliant talking with you. And I hope that through the examples that you've given and the model that you've talked through and then exemplified later on in this podcast, that that people who are listening into this will be able to think, actually, this is something that I need to know about. This is something I'm probably doing, even if I didn't think I was doing it. And the potential impact for this is right up there with some of the most important things that we'll be doing as teachers. And that's from everyone working with early years right through to those people working all the way through. In fact, obviously to our mentors working with the adults who are now going to be the teachers of the future.
You know, we call it teaching and learning. The reality is you can't learn something for somebody else. And so what we're trying to do with metacognitive behaviours is help them become better learners. And then through the time process of that, they're also obviously learning content for supporting excellent grades. But there is a much bigger ulterior motive and purpose behind it to support them in life, actually.
Brilliant. I think that's where we'll leave it there. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thanks, Matthew.